Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Gavin Newsom kicked off this year's Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with a new resource, launching a statewide hotline to report hate crimes. The goal is to create a safe space that allows people to make an anonymous report and be connected to services, as well as the option of law enforcement with the victim's consent. This comes as the state reports that the most recent data shows hate crimes have jumped 33% from 2020 to 2021, reaching their highest levels in two decades. Hate crimes span race, ethnicity, religion, gender, and sexual orientation. But since the start of the pandemic, Asian Americans have shouldered a brunt of disinformation, violent attacks caught on camera, as well as sparking a larger conversation about mental health following two mass shootings within the AAPI community in California at the start of the year. A national survey this year from the Asian American Foundation found that one in two Asian Americans report feeling unsafe in the U.S. due to their race or ethnicity. We're going to get a better understanding of how these numbers and how this data touches many parts of life. Sarah Mises-Tan is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter and the host of the podcast Mid-Pacific, which explores Asian American identity in California. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Vicky.
Okay, so we'll get to the new statewide hotline in just a moment. But first, I mean, Sarah, you're coming off the heels of a podcast that really dives into Asian American identity through food, family, politics, music, so much more. Now, although you didn't specifically touch upon this specific issue that we're going to be talking about, but throughout your conversations with Asian Americans across the state, did you get a better sense of how the past 3 years have impacted their sense of identity and sense of belonging in the United States?
Absolutely. I think the Asian American Foundation survey is right on the mark. The sense that I've gotten from folks I spoke with for the podcast is that many feel like we're in this period of maybe increased animosity against people who appear to be of East Asian descent, I'll be specific. And this is for a lot of reasons, but I definitely think that with this feeling comes some pressure to prove that you belong here in the U.S., something that is always an undercurrent of Asian American identity generally, but maybe more front and center right now. I think the result of these attacks has been that some Asian Americans are really leaning into that belonging idea, so really trying to prove that they are from here, that they are American. And on the other hand, I think that you see other Asian Americans wanting to distance themselves from being American, embracing their ancestry a little more, learning more about their background, and maybe wanting to identify more with that instead of the American side of them. So you see people on two ends.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so individual. I mean, the past few years can just feel like a blur, right? So much has happened since the attacks initially on Asian Americans began during the pandemic. But with the lens of a journalist and also the benefit of hindsight, how do you reflect on these hate crimes that took place against the AAPI community? And potentially what was already set into motion pre-2020 that might have set the stage for all of this?
So I think, unfortunately, many of the sentiments behind the hate crimes that we've seen in the recent years, they're just an upwelling of feelings that I think have long been simmering under the surface and that have just manifested in different ways in the past. I think that the hate crimes are just an extension of some of those like unsavory stereotypes about Asian Americans that, you know, as Americans, we've all kind of gotten used to do a little bit. These stereotypes were often left off in the past. I absolutely think that with the election of our former president and rhetoric around centering America and America first, the natural enemy of that kind of rhetoric does tend to be China. And this also amplified a lot of that tension. I think all of that to say, in some ways, the attacks that happened maybe gave a moment for us to actually acknowledge that these stereotypes and misconceptions about Asian Americans had been happening for so long. Whereas before, I feel like we didn't really have a way to talk about them. There was no tangible way to address them. A lot of Asian Americans kind of just maybe laughed it off or rolled it off or said, there's nothing really we can do about it right now. Mm-hmm. So positives and negatives.
Right. And also from your podcast, I mean, right from the get-go, we learned that Asian American is just this gigantic umbrella term for many countries, cultures, and immigration journeys. And that can be applied to a lot of immigration journeys that aren't even Asian American, right? There's so many countries that are part of these broad terms. But are these broad, important differentiations within this umbrella, are they reflected when we're talking about disinformation and hate crimes?
Oh, yeah. Great question. Obviously, yes. I don't think that people who are stereotyping or thinking about who these hate crimes are happening to are really making this distinction that Asian American is, like you said, very broad and diverse term. And I think that's, of course, the root of the problem right there. In a way, it has been a term that's been unifying for the Asian American diaspora, just because suddenly we're all being othered in a similar way and there can be some strength in coming together. But yeah, on the other hand, I think it can be extremely flattening to assume there is no nuance in the Asian American experience. I know there's also a lot of question from South Asians, just where they fit in with the term Asian American. They have also experienced hate crimes, but in a different way. And so in some ways, I also worry about just this kind of flattening the conversation and obscuring hate crimes that are happening in other parts of the Asian American community that may not come to mind just because they're not that immediate image of an Asian American that you might think of.
Yeah, given that this is an ongoing situation and conversation, how has your view of hate crimes against the AAPI community evolved today?
You know, like I said, I think that it's an expanded definition of hate crimes against Asian Americans. I think people maybe are quick to jump to like a certain image of like who is being hate crimed, I guess, when you think about hate crimes against Asian Americans. But yeah, through kind of covering this, I think I've come to realize, and a lot of people have pointed out to me, like, yes, of course, like Sikh Americans have been experiencing hate crimes since 9/11, just because of some of, you know, the turban that they wear and the way they look and the way that they're stereotyped. They are also technically Asian Americans under this term, but we don't often think of that as being part of this kind of continuum of hate crimes that's been happening. I kind of like, you know, it kind of drives home that point that maybe we kind of touched on mid-Pacific, which is that I would like for there to be more unity within the term Asian American. I know it's tough because there are so many differences, but if we could kind of see those common threads, I think there could be strength. Like maybe we could have seen like, oh yeah, this is happening to some of our Asian American brothers and sisters over here. It could also happen here. And, you know, I think I was speaking with former Senator Dr. Richard Pan recently, who just mentioned that, you know, overall, I think a lot of the things that happen in terms of hate crimes against Asian Americans tend to have roots internationally. And that, you know, it's almost irrelevant to what people, Asian American people, are doing here in this country. They're two separate things, I guess is what I'm trying to say. International relations with Asian countries are different from Asian American people who live here. Here's Senator Pan saying it much better than me.
Sometimes I think we do need to distinguish. There are things that are Asian and there are things that are Asian American. They're not the same, right? So, you know, because, I mean, so sometimes people, they talk about Asian American, they're really talking about Asian. And sometimes there are things that are uniquely Asian American. They're not really Asian. They're usually American.
Right. I mean, that's an important distinction that often gets lost, you know, when you're talking about stereotyping, right? I mean, because that's kind of the antithesis, is you're not making these distinctions. So when it comes to this new resource that the state just announced last week, California is, you know, this is in the spirit of the state making its own strides to combat the rise in hate crimes, not just for Asian Americans, but all Californians. The governor's administration has been promising a hotline for reporting hate crimes. Now we have it. So how does it work?
Sure. So the number, if you're looking for it, is 833-8-NO-HATE. And callers can receive assistance in over 200 languages, which is great. Essentially, though, I don't want to mislead people. And I don't know if the governor is trying to with this hotline either. It's just supposed to be a tool in the toolbox. But essentially, they are just trying to collect. They're trying to have a central place to collect data about hate crimes against Asian Americans that are happening within California. Right now, there isn't really a governmental body that's collecting that information. So it's important to keep that goal in mind, to know that this is not, I mean, I think they will help connect you to mental health resources if you call, but this is not a therapy hotline in any way. And this is not an action hotline in any way. So really what you're doing when you call this hotline is you're reporting something for the state to put down in their records. So they can have a running tally and have this data collected over many years, but it's really not an actionable place. So, you know, I get that when a hate crime happens, the victim kind of is looking for solutions. And unfortunately, this hotline is not going to provide that, I think, or not directly anyways.
Right. I mean, it said on the website that they're going to be, you know, there's potentially mental health resources and they can involve law enforcement with the consent of the person who's reporting this crime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think it's supposed to add to the attorney general's office in the state. They do track hate crimes, but their most recent data is from 2021. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not as we don't really know what it looks like in the last 2 years. So this will hopefully be, you know, kind of a more accurate reflection. This is obviously all in its infancy and with things that are in its infancy, it's going to grow. What do you think the potential challenges and its growing pains could actually be?
Yeah. So when I spoke with members of, I guess, there are some advisors who have been a part of this hotline creation, and I think a lot of them felt that the biggest challenges were going to be reaching those people who are most vulnerable to the hate crimes happening. So within the AAPI community, that does tend to be an older population that is not as tech savvy. They also tend to be a population that may not be comfortable speaking English as their first language. And they also tend to be a population that culturally is probably looking to just kind of keep their head down, blend in, be quiet. They're probably an older population as well. And so I think the challenge just comes with reaching that group, which is just always going to be hard to reach. So reaching them in language in a culturally competent way, and also kind of talking to them about why it would be important to call this hotline and report this when, you know, the immediate result of doing so may not be super obvious in the immediacy.
Yeah. So the state is obviously trying to increase outreach and awareness, but it's not only California, right? I mean, this also comes nationally as there's been some ground gained in terms of acceptance of Asian Americans. We just had a conversation with you, Kristen, and Janelle, who are also CAP Radio reporters, about just the strides in mainstream pop culture. But also there's positive relations with Asian countries as well. For example, President Biden recently hosted a White House dinner with the president of South Korea. How do you think these international embraces can shape the way Asians and Asian Americans are perceived?
Yeah, you know, on the one hand, in that like broad sense that Asian Americans are kind of stereotyped and Americans have an image of what an Asian American is, I hope that seeing something like the White House dinner with the president of Korea kind of, or South Korea, really kind of shows that there are better relations with people who look like they're of East Asian descent. But yeah, at the same time, like we talked about, Asian American is a huge term. Not everybody who is Asian American is South Korean. I think that, like, even within the Korean diaspora in America, I think you'll find more favorable kind of relations with America. Like, I'm partly Korean, and I can say my family kind of has a really positive image of America just because of the way the Korean War was and that kind of legacy and history there. So you could say, on the one hand, maybe this didn't change anything. Maybe Korean Americans were more primed to be kind of pro-America anyways because of the legacy of America in South Korea. On the other hand, maybe it's a good thing for white Americans to see the White House embracing an Asian American or an Asian culture. Mm. So,
you know, dipping into politics a little bit. I mean, we obviously have a presidential election that's quickly approaching next year. I mean, President Biden intends to run for re-election, but that doesn't mean that in the meantime, other names aren't being floated around. In the spirit of this conversation, I mean, particularly there's two Asian Americans, both women. I mean, of course, we have Vice President Kamala Harris, and we also have former Ambassador Nikki Haley. Both are the first South Asian Americans for their respective offices. So how do these high-profile officials who are, you know, kind of breaking ground, creating milestones in history, how do they fit into this broader conversation?
Yeah, I think these two candidates really represent a first step and a growing trend. I spoke with a demographer, Karthik Ramakrishnan, who's also a political scientist based at UC Riverside. He said that he actually thinks that we're going to start seeing more of this.
You know, if you think about it, there aren't too many second-generation Asian Americans that are above the age of 50. And why is that? Well, we had very restrictive immigration laws until 1965. You didn't see large-scale Asian immigration really pick up until the 1970s. And so the children of immigrants who came here in the 1970s are, you know, in their late 40s, maybe starting to approach 50 years old. So you're going to see a lot more Asian American candidates. So you have that kind of demographic wave that's rising.
Hmm. Well, finally, obviously, optics are huge in politics, you know, regardless of race, ethnicity, or gender. How do views of Asian Americans in this country ultimately shape the way that AAPI politicians have to present themselves to the public?
Oh, yeah. So I think because they are a relatively new demographic of candidate that's running for political office, I think that we've seen a lot of motion in our state, in California. I think we've seen less motion on the national stage, or once you get to those bigger political stages where maybe there is less familiarity with what an Asian American candidate is or the Asian American experience. Karthik says it better than me again, so we're going to hear he is again.
In California, you know, we've had many Asian American candidates who've been successful in local office, in congressional office, in statewide office. So I think it's important for us, especially in California, to recognize that. What we find is that unlike for many Latino and Black candidates, Asian Americans have to win in districts that are not majority Asian. And so they have to be bridge building from the beginning.
I think Asian American candidates in larger scale races where they're trying to win those non-Asian districts that Karthik mentioned, they're facing a lot of those larger stereotypes that we spoke about earlier. So this perceived foreignness coupled with stereotypes like that they're quiet, they're too quiet, they're just hard workers, they're kind of meek, they're not good upper management material, as people say. So that's that so-called bamboo ceiling that all Asian Americans face. Karthik mentioned, interestingly, former state treasurer and gubernatorial candidate in 2017, John Chung, who ran against Gavin Newsom and lost. And obviously, I think there are many reasons around that. But Karthik himself mentioned that whether or not this is real or not, Chung was just not perceived as being charismatic enough for a job, for that job. And I think that is a great example of some of those barriers that Asian Americans face when they're trying to run on a bigger political stage. But I think that there's also some hope that this pressure to kind of conform or present in a very particular way as an Asian American candidate, I hope it's going to fade in time. I know that, you know, we just recently spoke about Sheng Tao's historic win in Oakland. She is a candidate who ran partly on being unapologetically herself and unapologetically Asian American in all those complex ways. And so I do hope that that shows a new wave of expectations for Asian American politics to come.
Yeah. And Mayor Tao also is part of that new generation, right? I mean, she's in her 30s.
Absolutely.
You know, this new generation of Asian Americans in politics. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Vicky.
That is CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, who is also the host of the podcast Mid-Pacific, which explores Asian American identity in California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The unofficial start to summer is just a couple weeks away. Memorial Day signals a time to dust off the camping supplies, hiking boots, or other outdoor gear to bask in the fresh air and sunshine. But this year will look quite different in some spots of California compared to years past. The powerful storms this winter have led to many state parks that are partially or entirely closed, especially in the Sierra, where many campgrounds and popular trails remain buried under snow. In the central and eastern Sierra, Caltrans is working to remove like a wall of snow blocking miles of state highways in the passes. And all of this is presenting challenges for the people who call this area home and the businesses who rely on tourists for their livelihood. One of those counties is Tuolumne County, one of the gateways to Yosemite National Park, which closed twice so far this year due to snow and the threat of flooding. Lisa Mayo is with Visit Tuolumne and joins us to share the challenges her county is experiencing. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Vicki.
So you live in Sonora, and obviously you head Visit Tuolumne. What makes this corner of California such a special place for you?
Well, one of the things for me personally is that I grew up here, and so it's really great to have gone away to school and done some other things and landed back here and get to promote this great area. I mean, we have access to so many wonderful things right here in Tuolumne County. We have our Gold Rush history. We have our High Sierra. And of course, as you mentioned, we have Yosemite right in our backyard.
Yeah, when I think about the Gold Rush history, I mean, there's that Sierra Nevada Community of Columbia, which I believe is a state park or a historic park. And that really takes you back in time. It is such a charming place to visit. And you have some experience there when you were young serving ice cream, right?
That's right. Yeah, I did. That was my first real job outside of babysitting. Not that babysitting is not a real job, but my first one where I actually got a paycheck. And I think I was 15 years old when I started there. And really, that was my first jump into the world of tourism.
How do you reflect on the past 5 months of this year? I mean, this winter was just brutal.
This winter was insane. You know, there were some good things that came out of it. Dodge Ridge Ski Resort in our area here, just they were kind of in the bullseye of all the snows. They got the most snow they've ever received in a season. I think they got the most snow of many of the resorts in all of the Sierra. So it was a great season for them. But there was other issues, of course. We had just the winds and all the rain that was coming down as well. It actually caused a lot of cancellations for people that maybe weren't into going skiing or going up to play in the snow up at Leland. So it was a little challenging in that arena, but the bright light in all of this was that Dodge Ridge had their best season ever.
You know, how do things look like now? I mean, obviously we're getting into warmer temperatures, but there's still very much a snowpack and also the risk of flooding in some areas across the state.
Yeah, we have so much snow up the hill. It's incredible. We haven't seen walls of snow like that in years and years and years. So the challenge right now is getting access to the high country and to a lot of the activities that people come here to do. As you mentioned, Memorial Day is that unofficial kickoff this summer. And, you know, getting the roads cleared is a number one priority right now. And we've got a lot of great road, great local road crews that are working hard to get access for everyone getting up the hill. And when I say up the hill, I'm talking Highway 108, and getting those businesses open, getting them prepared for summer, all of that. So there's a lot of work to do, and we're just hoping that the warmer temperatures kind of help that snow melt. I know there can be issues with that as well, as you mentioned, the flooding. So hopefully we have a happy medium there of temperatures and snow melt.
What are the popular activities as we get into these warmer temperatures that might be hindered or impacted, you know, just due to the record or near record snowpack in parts of the Sierra?
Camping is one of the biggest reasons people come here in spring, summer, and even the fall months. And so there's a lot of closures right now. A lot of places that people are normally used to being able to get to at this time of year, that they're going to have to wait a little longer. We do have a lot of great opportunities for camping in the lower elevations where there's not snow. So that's a good thing. Horseback riding, going up to Kennedy Meadows and being able to stay in the cabins up there and get on a horse and go experience the high country on saddle. That's something that people love to do as well that is not available at the moment. Usually by Memorial Day weekend, they're open. There's still that possibility for that. We're keeping our fingers crossed.
Yeah, when I think of Tuolumne County, it's such a beautiful county. I think of Sonora, of course, but also Jamestown. You have beautiful lakes, but it is a gateway to Yosemite National Park, and that can be a draw for tourists from across the country or even internationally. How does this impact to Yosemite, which has experienced already two partial closures or just complete closures so far this year due to snow and due to the risk of flooding? How does that impact whether people are going to make the trip to Tuolumne County?
You know, that is, Yosemite is a key. It's a bucket list item for so many people, whether they are coming even from the Bay Area or from around across the world. Like you mentioned, we do have marketing agencies that we work with in the UK and Canada, Mexico. And so it's for a lot of those folks, they're coming here to see Yosemite. And so if they get here and the gates close, you can imagine the frustration that they might have. This might be their only trip here to do that. Right now, we're experiencing some road issues that have Highway 120 closed there at the entrance to Yosemite. So one of the things that we like to do is to really promote other parts of the park that people don't always think about, like Hetch Hetchy. Mm-hmm. And that is such a cool area. I mean, if you haven't been there, it's so great because you learn about the history of Hetch Hetchy and the reservoir and what it looked like before it was dammed, how the equipment got there by railroad, by horses, back in the day to build this dam. And that water there in Hetch Hetchy provides the water for the San Francisco Bay Area. So there's a lot of history there, but beyond that, can do some great hiking. You can see Wapama Falls, which is a 1,400-foot waterfall. It's incredible. And that is all in Yosemite National Park, outside of the main gate there at Big Oak Flat Road. So you can still access that, which I think is an incredible place for people to go as an alternative.
Given that you have been heading Visit Tuolumne for about a decade now, I mean, the past 4 years have just been a whiplash. I mean, you have the pandemic, you have the increasing threat of wildfires. There have been multiple in this area in recent years, not to mention a series of atmospheric rivers and snowpack. You know, how does that shape your work as in trying to get tourists to come visit, you know, Tuolumne County, which is a gateway to Yosemite?
Well, that is such a great question. And wow, that list, you really took me back there a little bit. I think there has been a lot there. When I started here the second year I was here in 2013, we had the Rim Fire. And that was really like, at the time, that was the third largest wildfire in California. Now I think it's like number 12. But that was really a learning point of like, wow, this is a real danger, a real thing that's happening in our area. And how do we deal with these things as they happen? Shortly after that, there was a government shutdown, you know, which shut down Yosemite National Park. So one of the things that I've really noticed in our area is that our partners that, whether they're outfitters or they're hoteliers or restaurants even, boy, are they resilient and are they able to really pivot? That's just, pivot is one of those words we overuse these days, but I think really it's something that they've been able to do on a dime almost. When we have these challenges, they are able to turn it around, make it a positive, still get people to come here. You know, I mean, of course, we're looking, if there's a wildfire and we have bad smoke, we're not going to tell people to come up here. We don't want people to, you know, visitors to get in the way of emergency services and things that are dealing with the fire. But, you know, it's just learning that timing of when you invite people back and how you invite them back. We work a lot with Visit California. They've been a great leader in crisis, as they have dealt with a lot of it throughout the state as well. So each crisis, I would say, is a little different, but we learn something each time and always try to come out with more opportunities on the other side.
At the heart of this are the people who call Tuolumne County home, and the county population is around 55,000. How are they doing?
I think that most of our folks are doing pretty well right now. The spring has been really incredible visitation. We've had some new initiatives like in the Christmas time, we had Christmas Town downtown Sonora, which is bringing more and more people in. We have great events happening all the time. So our residents, I think, they're participating in those events after a few years of just not being able to do a whole lot. We're seeing huge turnouts. We just had our first farmers market in East Sonora this last Friday, and there was nowhere to park. Everyone wants to be out and about and seeing each other and having that social aspect. But it's, you know, it's a great place to live, and we have a friendly community and people that want to be involved and make it a better place.
That is wonderful to hear. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Lisa Mayo with Visit Tuolumne about how the severe winter storms are impacting the county's tourism. Okay, so Memorial Day weekend is fast approaching. It's a little over 2 weeks away, and that often is a time when people head to the Sierra to enjoy all of these outdoor activities, right? Camping, hiking, fishing. You know, how will this holiday weekend look different or feel different compared to previous years?
Well, people will not be able to access a lot of the high country camping areas that they are used to. I would highly recommend that they check with Stanislaus National Forest before coming to see if their campground is open or not. And I would also encourage people that are finding that they don't have the campground that they want or that they normally go to available, that they check other areas of the county as well. We have like Lake Don Pedro, which has a lot of great camping around it. The lake is full. It's incredible. You can rent boats, go fishing, hiking, all those great things, just at a lower elevation. But it's going to be, I think, a beautiful summer. We have, up in the high country, once the snow does start melting, we'll have some incredible wildflowers. We'll, you know, for people to go hiking up in that area, we have wildflowers now. On some really great trails here at the, like out of Tuolumne, we have an old railroad grade, and there's a great trail there called the West Side Trail that is full of wildflowers right now. So there's a lot of great options if you can't make it to your favorite spot just yet.
You know, when you touched upon Highway 120, which is closed, you know, Big Oak Flat Road, I think about, you know, it's also a great advantage when you can jump from county to county in this area, right? You know, you think of Yosemite and what surrounds it. You have Tuolumne County, you have Inyo and Mono County, as well as Mariposa County. And often, you know, people want to jump around and enjoy the outdoors. How does the closure, potential closures of highways and really thoroughfares that get you from one county to the next across the Sierra, how does this impact, you know, the accessibility of getting around?
That's a really great question. And that's really a heart of the challenge that we are facing, is that we have passes on either side of us that are anticipated to open in July. So when you're asking people to come to Tuolumne County or head over to Mono County, you know, Highway 108 is a key thoroughfare. And when we don't have those passes open, people have to go way far out of their way.
It adds hours to the drive, to the commute.
Absolutely. Hours and hours. And plus, we can lose those folks, you know, they might decide to stop somewhere else. And then, you know, they cut their trip shorter or, you know, realize, oh, it's too far to go. So it's really, really important that we get that Sonora Pass Highway 108 open, because it is a key corridor going back and forth, like I mentioned. And we do have, we talked about earlier, the international travelers. A lot of them do this loop going from Vegas to Yosemite, to San Francisco, LA, you know, that it's a very popular loop. And we will lose a lot of those travelers if we aren't able to get the pass open in time.
You know, all of this also comes, we've had Yosemite on in the past in earlier this year, and they're preparing to eliminate its reservation system, which has been in place since the pandemic. What impact do you think this will have on tourism?
Well, I think the reservation system itself was a little bit of a deterrent for a lot of visitors. And it was a challenge for us trying to highlight this area that is a key icon for people to come here. It's where they want to go. I think with lifting the reservation system, you're still going to have folks that think one's in place, so they're not even going to try to visit, for one. But also, we're trying to set like a base year to get back to not having that system? And what does that look like? Because during the last 3 years or so, when the system's been in place, the park has worked on some different traffic initiatives, like additional parking and roundabouts and things like that. So I think they're looking at this as a base year to see how that traffic is going to be managed this year, how the visitors are going to be managed and move about the park, to see what they might need to do in the future to control that.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly has been challenges, but there's been some blessings as well. You touched upon Dodge Ridge Ski Resort, and they had their earliest opening in almost two decades. They recorded like 63 feet of snow. I believe that was an all-time season record that was set over a decade ago, which is amazing. You know, how has this season helped establish Dodge Ridge and the surrounding businesses, maybe as an alternative to other popular resort areas like Mammoth or Lake Tahoe?
I think Dodge Ridge is one of those ski resorts where a lot of people, when you talk to them, are like, oh, I learned how to ski there, myself included. And I also worked there when I was younger. And, you know, it's, I think people realized, like, when they couldn't maybe get over the passes to Tahoe or to go further out, that they rediscovered Dodge Ridge. And it is such a wonderful family resort. They've started their terrain park up again. They've done some really great things there to expand their offerings. And so I think this year, not only did they make the news a lot because of all the snow that they were getting, but again, people that maybe skied there as a kid and haven't been there in years revisited and maybe brought their families. So hopefully some new traditions were started this year at Dodge Ridge. We are so excited for them. And we love that they are now offering things year round as well. This summer, they'll have where you can take your mountain bike up the chairlift and bike down the mountain. So some really cool things happening there.
Yeah. Another perk are those wildflower blooms in across Nevada and California. We've had guests from both Nevada and California for this regional statewide look at these super blooms that are taking place. Now, although like a lot of areas have already peaked, Tuolumne County can have longer bloom seasons sometimes due to the county's varying elevations. Are there still some good places to take in these wildflowers in May and June?
There really are. Right now, I just touched on it earlier, in the town of Tuolumne, there's a historic railroad grade, which railroad grades make great trails, especially if you have little ones, because they're going to be flat for the most part. But this is a beautiful trail that goes out, and you can see the Tuolumne River Canyon from there. But right now, there are so many flowers on that trail that it's just incredible. Great place for photos. And then once this, we start seeing some snow melt, and maybe in June, July, one of my favorite trails is up there in the forest, and it's called Waterhouse Trail. And there was a year I can remember going through there and just being waist high in incredible wildflowers of all colors and species. And, you know, it's just a really beautiful spot. So I anticipate that we'll have a pretty long wildflower bloom this year.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for a lay of the land.
Thank you.
Lisa Mayo is with Visit Tuolumne, one of the gateway counties to Yosemite National Park. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento is often regarded as the underdog city in sports, but the tide has recently turned a little bit. In just the past year, both collegiate and professional sports in the capital city have defied odds with overdue success. But decades before, an underdog story catapulted to international level. The Arden Hills Swim and Tennis Club might not sound like a winning team, but they would go on to create an Olympic dynasty. In the new book, Victory in the Pool, historian and author Bill George details the story of a local swim club that led to the 1968 and the 1972 Olympic Games. And Bill joins us to discuss his new book. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Vicky.
You know, you were here not too long ago, back in March, and you were talking to us about a documentary on Rancho Cordova, which aired on KVIE, our local PBS station, detailing the city's history. Where did your love of just diving into Sacramento County history, where did it stem from?
I've always loved history, and I live here, so it was the obvious choice. We have a great and rich history, and I want to tell it.
How did you stumble upon the Arden Hills Swim Club?
Well, it's such a great story, and it's a story about people. It's a story about a coach named Sherm Shavor, who lived in Oakland, rose from poverty, went in the Army, came out, went to the YMCA here in Sacramento. That was his first swim job. Now, he always said he was a swimming coach who didn't know how to swim, and he really was not a technician or anything. He'd gone through the Army, been in charge of a recreation program, then came here. In that pool, he found some Japanese-American boys who had been in the camps during the war. They came out. They had learned to swim there a little bit, but he took those boys, an African-American kid and a couple of white kids, and he made his first great swim team out of it. That's what began the dynasty. He rose from there, from the YMCA, coaching these kids who had no training, to be the most famous, powerful, and influential Olympic coach in history. And there's no lie. He's unbelievable. And I'm just glad that story came out. Did he have his warts? Yeah, he had warts. Did everybody like him here? No, they didn't. He used to yell at people. He yelled at my mother-in-law.
Really?
Oh, yeah. She would go swimming there recreationally. He'd turn that faucet off. You're wasting hot water. So since I've written a book and it's come out, I've gotten more emails from people. It's almost like a badge of honor now that Sherm yelled at him. So it's a great story, though. And the people, like I said, this is not about people with their heads underwater, right? Swimming, that's people think of. These are real characters. Takaseri was the first great swimmer, the Japanese-American boy. I tracked him down. He's still with us, thank God. He told me all the stories of how Sherm motivated him. He'd yell at him, get in the pool. What are you doing? Trying to get a suntan? What are you guys doing? Work, 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 work. And, you know, that's how he motivated people. It was the constant workout method. And just unbelievable.
Yeah, I imagine the anecdotes are endless, and especially just the tip of the iceberg, especially following this book, because clearly he's touched so many lives, you know, in a comforting or an abrasive way,
right,
you know, as we're learning about him. So being successful in and of itself, you know, is great, and it takes work ethic, but you don't necessarily think it leads to the Olympics.
Right.
I mean, how did that happen?
Well, he said himself, you have to have the talent in the pool. But how did it happen? And there's talent in lots of pool. So one of his first great swimmers was a kid named Mike Burton. Mike Burton became the greatest long-distance swimmer in history. He redefined long-distance swimming. He won 3 Olympic gold medals. It's a freaky story. One day, he's riding on the handlebars of a friend's bike. They get blasted by a truck. He goes into surgery, 8 hours of surgery, gets out and basically can hardly walk. He'd been a good athlete, basketball, baseball, all that. Not so much baseball. There you go, Mike. That's for you. He always complained that he wasn't a good baseball player. But he had this work ethic in him. He came, went to Shavor, and Shavor didn't care what your strokes look like. He cared about one thing, guts. Mm. Do you have the guts to do it? Because swimming is brutal. People don't realize the pain involved. And a guy like Mike Burton went in that pool, even though he was from a poor neighborhood here in Sacramento. There already were established swimmers at Arden Hills, but he outworked everyone. He'd pick the guy at the top, and he'd say, I'm going to beat him. And he went in the pool and worked and worked and worked. Shavor had studied what does it take to make a great distance athlete, either running, swimming, or whatever. He'd work with Japanese. He'd studied Roger Bannister, the first guy to break the 4-minute mile, his techniques. And he came up with this whole program he called over-distancing, which is a polite word for torture.
torture. Yeah, I think it's also important to take in the context of the time that we're talking about, the period in American history, right? Because these Olympic wins, they happened during the 1960s and the 1970s. I mean, this was an intense time. You had the civil rights movement. You also had Cold War tensions. You know, where does that fit into this team that went and was successful on an international level?
Right. So Shavor and the swimmers drive the narrative, but I do touch on all of those things because those are things that they encountered. So yes, the war in Vietnam was going on, also the Cold War. The Olympics at that time were a test of which society is better, communism or capitalism, America or Russia. There was a tremendous amount of pressure on the kids to perform, and the swimming team especially. They would write, success in the Olympics in 68 depends on how well the American swimmers do. They didn't have to just win. They had to win overwhelmingly and bring home the gold, or the Russians were going to beat them. So Shavor was aware of that. It was so crazy. So Debbie Meyer, one of the great names in swimming.
Three-time Olympic medalist.
Three-time Olympic medalist. She comes in, and she, in 67, in 3 years, she'd come to Sacramento in 64. In just 3 years, she became the top female swimmer in the world. She was so good that TASS named her Athlete of the Year, the Russian news agency TASS. This stuff didn't happen. And there were newspaper articles written that this could be a real breakthrough in East-West relations because Debbie Meyer, who everybody loved, they admit, and even the Russians love her. So it was very interesting. So all kinds of things were going on.
What came of the Arden Hill Swim Club? I mean, these are major successes decades ago, and yeah, you don't really hear about it so much now.
It's still there, but Sherm Shavor sold out as he got older, and it's been taken over. It's still there, and they mainly do a lot of weddings and stuff. I don't think they have a swim team now.
Hmm. You know, what I love, I keep going back to how your mother-in-law has an anecdote about Sherm Shavor, which really hits home how Sacramento is, you know, in this one sense, a very small town,
right,
a small community. But you're talking about how this, well, also a small town, really reached an international stage and has a place in American and Olympic history.
Oh, it's a huge place, yeah, a huge place, and it shouldn't be forgotten.
I love that juxtaposition.
Yes, and it was neighborhood kids like other swim clubs. Santa Clara nearby us was a big power, but they brought in kids from around the country. That didn't happen much. It happened a little bit here. But Sue Peterson, one of the first great female swimmers, at age 10, she was famous in Sacramento. At age 10, she was setting records. And the headlines would say, Sue wins 100-yard race. Sue, it wasn't even Sue Peterson. Well, then along came Debbie Meyer, and all of a sudden, Sue had a rival, and Shavor said, I had the best rivalry going. So the two of them would go at it and battle. Debbie moved here when her dad was transferred to Campbell Soup. She came from Haddonfield, New Jersey. But she hadn't been swimming that much, just recreation. And just like Mike Burton, she got in the pool and saw all these kids churning away. And boy, she almost quit. At first, she went home and told her mom, I can't do this. These kids are crazy. I can't swim like this. But she got that fire in the belly, and she turned out there. And whoom, did she go. At the height of her success, as you mentioned, the three gold medals in 68, she was probably the most famous person in the world, certainly most famous female swimmer in the world. These were the first time in 68 that the Olympics were broadcast in color globally. These kids were huge celebrities. Think about it. There weren't 100 stations with every game known to man on. I grew up in Chicago. I remember watching these. I knew who all these guys were, especially Debbie. And to see what they did and under the circumstances, it's amazing. Plus, they're great people.
Is she still around?
She's still around. She lives
as well as Mark Spitz and Mike Burton?
Spitz and Burton. Spitz lives in L.A. and Burton lives in Colorado, but he gets here once in a while. But the Mark Spitz story is another one. People are all kind of confused about Mark Spitz. First of all, yes, he learned to swim here competitively under Sherm Shavor. When he was, I think, 12, they moved. The story was that he was moving to Santa Clara to get better coaching. That's demonstrably not true. I show that in the book. He moved because his dad got a job. He went to Santa Clara when he was 18. He was the preeminent swimmer in the world. He'd set all kinds of world records. He bombed the 68 Olympics. Two gold, two silver, doesn't sound like bombing, but far under expectations and nothing in an individual event, all relays. Spitz ended up getting in a big argument, and his father, who was very domineering with the coach at Santa Clara, George Haynes. So within time, a year or so, they moved really back to Arden Hills. Spitz went to Indiana, where he had a coach. Spitz was lucky to have great coaches. But Chavor is the one who stayed with him, and Chavor is the one who made it possible for Mark Spitz to go to Munich and win the 7 gold medals. It would not have happened without Jim Chavor. 7. And the agony that he went through that week, Spitz, mentally, is chronicled in my book. And the feat that Jim Chavor pulled off by getting into Mark's heads. And I'll tell you one quick story. They're out to dinner with Sports Illustrated reporters. Spitz wasn't doing much media, but he had a favorite Sports Illustrated reporter. So Sherm, Spitz, and reporter went out to dinner. And Spitz could be a hypochondriac. And he's like, you know, Sherm, I'm not feeling well. You know, those pills, this would always happen with him coming up to big meets. He'd start to make all these kind of excuses why he couldn't perform. He said, I don't know. I'm feeling dizzy. And without missing a beat, Chavor says, dizzier. Right there, he set the shot. And suddenly Spitz, you know, realized, because in front of the reporter, that he better shape up and go. So, but Chavor was with him every step of the way through that, even though he was still also coaching the U.S. Olympic swim team at the same 72 Munich Olympics. And then, of course, we had the really tragic ending to that. So Mark Spitz is Jewish. Mark Spitz was in the middle of that. Sherm Chavor invented ways to keep Spitz out of the limelight, out of notice while the massacre was going on. Mm-hmm. It was tragic, but they were really worried that Spitz was going to be a target of the assassins.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for just doing all the work, the heavy lift, and just a remarkable story. Victory in the Pool is a new book from Bill George, an author and historian in Sacramento. And he's also going to be having an event May 13th, this Saturday, at the Sacramento Central Library. We have more information on our Insight page if you want to see Bill in the flesh. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.